Thanks to Jila. Thanks to all of you for coming today. It's a privilege to be part of such a panel of distinguished women. I'd like to talk to you today a little bit about democratization in the Middle East, and most in particular in Iran and Iraq. Democracy is on the move across the Middle East. I won't say on the march just yet, because the challenges it faces are still very great. But just as parents cheer the first baby steps of a child who cannot yet walk, much less run, so we should applaud and support the emerging signs of change and reform in the Middle East. And women at last are beginning to take their places within that process of reform, from Afghanistan to Bahrain and Iraq. As President Bush said in his January 2006 State of the Union address, quote, "The advance of freedom is the great story of our time. America and its partners and allies among the liberal democracies are leading the effort to allow men and women everywhere to participate meaningfully in the decisions that affect their lives, their futures, and those of their children. We see that wherever and whenever the forces of oppression are pushed back, more representative systems emerge. Clearly, when people are given a choice, they choose democracy. The surge of hope and optimism that accompanies the establishment of a democratic infrastructure in Afghanistan, the elated faces of Iraqis holding up purple-stained fingers as they emerge from polling stations, or the achievement by women in Bahrain of full political rights to run and vote in elections, however, must not be allowed to obscure the reality that there are angry and sometimes powerful forces that would not only halt these nascent movements toward democracy, but would turn back the clock by many, many centuries in some cases. The vision of radical Islamists for the people of the Middle East and beyond is quite different from our own. Democracy is about the power of ordinary people to influence and check the power of their governments. The murderous ideology of Islamist radicals instead seeks to enslave whole nations and intimidate the world. Power, they say, is too important to entrust to ordinary humans who so often go astray. And so it must be reserved to themselves, and all others should submit. These radicals fear freedom and distrust human creativity for a very simple reason. They cannot control the directions that free people and free societies may choose to go. Unable to inspire people with their totalitarian ideology, they turn instead to violence in the mistaken belief that coercion can control the human spirit. And so bombs, bullets, and suicide vests are the means by which they seek to enforce their vision. Now, some say that democracy is not well suited to the Middle East, because Islam and Arabic cultures haven't had much experience with democracy, or because the faith and traditions of the Middle East are so different from those that allowed democracy, ultimately, to flourish in the West. The virulent anti-American hatred of some, the antipathy to freedoms of speech, association, religion, and independent decision-making, especially by women, of others, the denial to ordinary citizens of the right to choose their leaders and make their own laws of yet others, give pause to many who see the huge investment of American blood and treasure we are making and say, why? We have great needs here at home, health care for our citizens, the entire Gulf Coast to rebuild. And they would be right, but they would also be missing a big part of the picture. When the forces of totalitarian Nazism, fascism, communism, and empire, the oppression of the gulag and the killing fields darkened huge swathes of the earth in the 20th century, Americans were resolute and clear-eyed. This was evil of the worst kind, and we were determined to oppose it and end it no matter what it took. Now it's another kind of totalitarianism that threatens our way of life and impedes the potential of democracy. Radical Islamism, however small its numbers among the world's 1.2 billion Muslims or so may be, has clamped a desperate grip of hatred on too many minds. Their objectives are clear because they've told us about them in no uncertain terms, with videos, audio tapes, letters, declarations. They told us on 9/11, in Madrid on 3/11, in London in July of 2005, in Riyadh in May of 2004, in Casablanca in May 2003, across Israel for so many years, and now in Iraq and in Iran, with the venomous pledge of a head of state to obliterate a neighbor from the face of the map. Isolationism is not an option, however some may wish that it were. We know now that the radicals will come after us. Indeed, they already are among us. The terrorists seek to create an empire of fear with their beheadings and explosions and ominous warnings from dark caves. And the only way to make sure that they don't succeed is to strengthen and expand the community of the nations of freedom. And so the United States, our partners, friends, and allies, are making a stand in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in Iran. Because the goal of Al-Qaeda, the extremist jihadis, and now the terrorist theocrats in Iran, is to carve out a base of operations from which to expand their murderous ideology. They seek to control, gain control of a country, any country, such as Afghanistan or Iraq, and then use that as a base from which to launch attacks and conduct war against non-Muslim governments or Muslim governments that do not match up to their definition of legitimacy. If ever these extremists were to succeed in driving out of the region Americans and others who stand for liberty, they would try to use that victory to rally other Muslims worldwide to rise up against moderate governments or governments attempting to modernize and reform in order to recreate the mythical caliphate of their imaginations. This is what happened in Afghanistan under the Taliban, and this is what happened in Iran under the clerical regime, and this is what was envisioned for Iraq. A rogue regime or a failed state is a magnet for terrorists, narco-traffickers, brigands, and lawlessness of all kinds. The repression of ordinary people that is required to maintain power by force leads as well to the most awful forms of human rights abuses, and in particular, as we have heard today, the human rights of women and girls, which we see increasingly in Iran since the ascension to power of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps regime under Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. With this challenge before us, then, and the consequences of failing to meet it with firm moral clarity so obvious, it is neither naive nor merely idealistic that America should take a stand to defend the liberty that we treasure by helping to ensure that others also share in its benefits. Idealistic, yes, but more importantly, assisting democracy to flourish in the Middle East supports American national security interests, and that is imperative. Iraq is the central battleground of that struggle for democracy now. Operation Iraqi Freedom toppled a murderous dictator who threatened the stability of the entire region. But the insurgency that followed demonstrates just how critical it is that Iraq's transformation from dictatorship to democracy should succeed. The ongoing violence in Iraq, and especially the flow of foreign fighters to the conflict, form the clearest evidence that the enemy, too, understands that an Iraq free, prosperous, and democratic denies to them yet another territory from which to operate and attack. That is why defeat of the insurgency is critical, but the firm establishment of civil society, rule of law, and representative government is absolutely paramount. As Arabs across the political spectrum in Iraq are coming to realize, it is the full spectrum of a democratic system that can best deliver to their people a secure future with the opportunities that they all desire. For democracy to succeed, the insurgency in Iraq must be defeated, make no mistake. This war has been a crucible of adaptation and changes for the United States and coalition armed forces as they have learned to deal with urban warfare and the tactics of asymmetric warfare. Early tactics that proved ineffectual have been replaced with new ways of dealing with roadside bombs, small arms attacks, and an enemy that fades away into the civilian population. Retired U.S. Army officer Andrew Krepinevich shook things up with a reminder that territory taken is not territory gained unless it is held and expanded. The Pentagon is developing renewed appreciation for civil affairs officers, training specialists, and linguists. Better body armor, better small arms better small units tactics, better intelligence all contribute to the steady progress that we see today in Iraq. Above all, the Iraqis themselves continue to shoulder more and more of the responsibility for their own defense and security. At the end of the day, though, winning the military struggle for Iraq is only the first step in the democratic transformation of that country. Success in drawing all of Iraq's ethnic and religious groups into the democratic process is ultimately where the battle for Iraq will be won or lost. Because the insurgency has always been centered in the Sunni triangle, the ethnic heartland of Iraq's Sunni population, cracking that base of support was mission critical. Once the key Sunni tribe sheikhs began to be convinced that their people's chances were better served inside rather than outside of the political system, the insurgency was broken. Not over, but dealt a fatal blow. It gradually became apparent that this was happening with the various elections of 2005. Now it is reported that the Sunni tribes are becoming fed up with the endless and mindless violence of the foreign jihadis, and perhaps even are forcing some of them to flee Iraq. Once the sea these fighters swim in becomes inhospitable to them, they can no longer survive there. And once the flow of foreign fighters into Iraq is reversed, the people of Iraq themselves will begin to see the balance of forces begin to tip, and very likely increasingly will start to align themselves with what they perceive to be the new order. While that new order obviously will be dominated by Shiites, however, it is also important to ensure that minorities of all Iraq's communities, women included especially, can be confident that their rights will be protected and represented. By sticking so determinedly with a schedule for institution building in Iraq, from National Assembly elections to the writing and approval of the Constitution to the most recent elections, in which for the first time in Arab history a population turned out the incumbent national leader at the ballot box, the administration sent an unmistakable message to those who think they can win by the gun. Violence will no longer determine the course of Iraqi democracy. Iraq has a long way to go, but it's on its way and moving in the right direction. Not so with all of Iraq's neighbors, especially next door in Iran. U.S. and European policy has failed miserably to encourage democratic reform. As a result of over 26 years of theocratic rule there, Iran today remains the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism, seeks unceasingly to disrupt any chance for peace in the Arab-Israeli conflict, is meddling massively in Iraq's nascent democratic venture, and now approaches the verge of a nuclear weapons capability. Egregious human rights abuses, especially against women and girls, draw repeated denunciations from rights organizations around the world, but to little effect. Until recently, the Bush administration has made, up until now, a very good faith effort to support the European policy of dialogue with Iran. The European perspective was that engagement had a better chance of instigating reform than constitution. Economic interests played a role as well. It seems now, though, they will be disappointed on both counts. After many years of such efforts, it seems that international patience with Iran is wearing thin at last. Iran continues to harbor al-Qaeda leadership figures, to offer safe haven to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and his murderous thugs, and to support terrorist organizations such as Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which seek the destruction of the State of Israel. Recent ballot box success for Hamas hardly signifies the advent of genuine democracy or peace for the Palestinians, as made quite clear by Hamas leader Khaled Mashal, who recently said, quote, "Before Israel dies, it must be humiliated and degraded," end quote. The lesson to be taken here is that mere elections must not be equated with genuine democracy, and in some cases, the process of democratization ought to precede the mechanism of elections. It has been especially the continuing drive of the terrorist theocracy in Tehran to acquire nuclear weapons, however, that has brought into very clear focus the dangers to the rest of the world attendant in allowing a rogue regime to operate unchecked. Instead of responding with firm red lines and unequivocal requirements for membership in the international community of nations, the world instead turned President Teddy Roosevelt's advice on its head. Walk softly and carry a big carrot seems to have been the message that Tehran has heard. The courage of Iranian dissidents, reformers, and regime opponents alone has not been sufficient without the solid support of the international community behind them. When President Bush told Iran's oppressed people, "And to the Iranian people I say, as you stand for freedom, America stands with you," hope surged. In his most recent State of the Union address last month, President Bush spoke again directly to the Iranian people, acknowledging that, quote, "Iran is a nation now held hostage by a small clerical elite that is isolating and repressing its people." Just as this kind of forthright speech by President Ronald Reagan brought hope and encouragement to the millions trapped behind the Iron Curtain, so our own administration can let oppressed Iranians know that they are not alone. By speaking directly to the people, calling for the release of political prisoners by name, and refusing to give legitimacy to a criminal regime. Hundreds of demonstrations, arrests, and outright rebellions in a number of Iranian provinces later, the people of Iran still wait. They see what is happening next door in Iraq and take encouragement from the growth of democracy there. They see that Iraqi citizens now have enshrined basic human rights in their new constitution, and they want the same thing. Journalists, students, bloggers, ordinary citizens risk and lose their lives to press their demands for real, not sham, democracy and freedom. The internet and international satellite broadcasting offer unprecedented opportunities to reach the people of Iran directly, but much, much more money needs to be dedicated to such media avenues as Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberties, Radio Farda. The Iran Democracy Act and bills introduced in the House of Representatives by Representative Ileana Ros-Lehtinen, Republican of Florida, and in the Senate by Senator Rick Santorum, Republican of Pennsylvania, if all passed and fully funded and implemented, would serve notice to the clerical regime that their days are numbered. And above all, removing the democratic Iranian opposition group, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, and its umbrella organization, the National Resistance Council of Iran, from the foreign terrorist organizations list would go a long way towards making clear to the clerics that terrorism, violence, and abuse that threatens the security of the world will no longer be tolerated, not by Mullah Omar, not by Saddam Hussein, and not by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and Ali Khamenei. Let me note that just in the past couple of days, I have read the news that in Britain, the House of Lords in particular has succeeded in bringing the issue of the listing of the MEK on Britain's own terrorist organizations list. They have succeeded in bringing that issue before the British government, which has agreed to review that situation and review the status of the MEK on Britain's terrorist organizations list. Unfortunate that Britain should be taking the lead instead of the United States, but perhaps we should follow. Recent action by the IAEA Board of Governors in voting to refer Iran to the United Nations Security Council, and hopefully soon by the Security Council itself, will demonstrate to Tehran that the international community is united and resolved, that their terrorist regime will not be permitted to acquire a nuclear weapons capability. If a Security Council referral doesn't get their attention, then application of targeted economic sanctions and an escalating program of coercive diplomatic measures will have to follow. Nor can the ultimate threat of military action be taken off the table. Regime change is coming to Tehran sooner or later. For the sake of the Iranian people, for the national security of the United States, and for the cause of democracy everywhere, let it be sooner. If we all step up to our collective responsibility for supporting peace and stability in the Middle East and promoting the spread of democracy there, it will be. Thank you.